Hello. Good evening. It's Radio Free Nintendo, and I'm your host, James Jones. I'm joined today by Mr. Greg Leahy.
Ahoy, ahoy, everyone.
Mr. John Lindemann.
James, I believe you are trying to say the date, so it is February the 11th, 2016. That was what you wanted to do from last show, remember?
I did. I was staging for that, John.
I'm just trying to cover all the bases.
You made the fatal error, John, of taking anything that James said as to be sincere.
Actually, I intended to do the date after I finished the introductions with Mr.
All
Guillaume
right, everybody's just getting used to it.
I can confirm it is February 11th.
This is your breaking news.
That's right. Break CNN. Somebody tell CNN they need to update the graphics.
Yeah.
It's still February the 11th.
It's gonna be like the Democratic debate replayed with that breaking news, February 11th. Anyway, it's also episode 453.
No, I'm sorry.
463.
463. I'm tired. I've been up since...
God, here we go.
Late. Here it's been a long time. It's been a long day.
Bring in the violins, John, baby. Bring them in.
I may have been drinking. It's fine. Everything's fine.
Oh, God. We're going to have to talk about Caligula.
We don't want the
again.
Excuses. We just want you to get better.
I'm actually, you know, Guillaume.
Like a true sports fan there, Guillaume. You could do it if you want.
It's not a matter of getting better. It's a matter of getting better at holding my liquor. That's what it really comes down to. Actually, I didn't have that much. I had a beer, and I'm just tired. Mm-hmm. So... You know, John.
I am agreeing. Mm-hmm. I'm saying, as in, I believe you, James. I appreciate your transparency.
Apparently you don't appreciate editing because I'm reading the emails because we're going to do emails only this week because we're starting late. Not because of my drinking. My drinking was tied to the event that caused us to start late, but it was not the actual cause of us starting late.
Absolutely,
don't have a
problem. James. Yes, sir. Yes.
It was pre-announced, but.
Your drinking was pre-announced, absolutely. We knew you would be drinking. We knew it. We know the code words, such as, I'm working late, I'm getting up, I'm going to lunch, I'm eating. Yeah, I know. Anyways.
Look, it's basically bread in a bottle, when you really think about it. But, since we're going to be doing an email-only episode, we don't have an order to go in, so... John's going to read the first email, but first, if you want to send us an email, you can send it to Radio Free, to RFN. Oh, God damn it. You can send it to RFN at IntenderholdReport.com. I'm really, really
If
tired.
Anybody really wanted a new business segment, mine was trying to beat Fire Leo. So we'll cover that next week.
But John did us a favor and picked out the emails for us because I just didn't have time this week.
Hey,
and
I don't need any pat on the back, James.
I'm thanking you, John. I'm thanking you for your hard work and then also not editing this email at all. So go ahead and read it.
I'll just read it. Your show is fantastic. Jim writes. Sorry. Jim writes, Dear RFN, your show is fantastic. I recently got back into video games after a long hiatus, and your show has really increased my enjoyment immensely. My gaming experience has huge gaps. I didn't play anything between Intellivision, NES, Genesis, and the Xbox. I then didn't make it to the next generation because lifestyle changes prevented me from tying up the TV and handheld gaming never appealed to me. Recently, after playing more and more games on my phone, I became more open to handheld gaming and I craved a richer experience than what I felt phone games offered. So I bought a 3DS and I really love it. I have two questions. I'm a big fan of Western RPGs and shooters. I understand that up front Nintendo didn't really do shooters, but I was a little surprised that there aren't any Western RPG options, at least that I'm aware of. I'm interested in Japanese RPGs, but I've never played one before. So far, I've experimented a bit with Fire Emblem, Monster Hunter 4, and Final Fantasy 4 on iOS. I'm considering buying Xenoblade and Bravely Default 2. Do you have any advice for a novice? This is going to be the first question. Do you have any advice for a novice on how to approach them? I'm sure I can figure out how to play them, but I'm interested in your opinion on what is it about the genre that makes it fun? And what should I know about the general differences between Western and Japanese RPGs so that I can approach the experience with the appropriate expectations? My favorite Western RPGs are Morrowind, Knights of the Old Republic, and Mass Effect, if that helps at all. That's the first question.
So, I mean, at a high level, the differences is pretty deep, actually. So Japanese RPGs tend to be a bit more, you know, narrow-focused in like, run the storyline. Like, it's much more driven around... you know, there is a narrative, usually at silly at some level, narrative that they want you to experience directly. It's a very story-driven experience, but that also means the characters are very much locked to the story. So you have these characters, you usually get a party of people that are of specific classes, including the main character, and the stat progression is usually pretty linear. You level up, you gain stats. You level up, you gain stats. There's obviously some variability in that. You know, you can maybe some have focuses, or you can pick what stats to level up, but it's not closer to the more open format of a Western RPG. And of course, I'm speaking in generalities here, where you build the character that you want to build. You set the stat points on what you want. You can create very, very different characters. Monster Hunter actually speaks a little bit closer to that sort of style, if you've played that, versus imagine in Monster Hunter if you had a party and you didn't directly control the characters, usually. There are some exceptions. And the builds were pre-locked on each of those characters. Like, that's kind of the difference. John, you could speak to this a bit yourself because you spent some time with some Western RPGs in the day.
Yeah, I mean, Western RPGs...
A very small amount of time for RPG.
Well, I mean, Western RPGs have kind of tended to be more open world recently.
Yeah.
And, I mean, if you look at all those games like Skyrim, Morrowind, Mass Effect, I mean, they're all effectively, like, you know, variations on... They're kind of like Grand Theft Auto sort of style of gameplay.
Mass Effect less.
Mass Effect is less. Mass Effect is... Yeah, you're right. Absolutely. But they're kind of moving towards that, where it's kind of more... what you're doing is more open-ended. Almost like a game called Xenoblade Chronicles X.
The thing. I mean, the Xenoblade Chronicles on Wii is more of your sort of classic JRPG kind of setup, and then XV is more towards the Western side, which Takashi said himself was kind of what he was going for. You know, that's what he wanted to make, interestingly enough, even though, you know, it was kind of hard to see it doing all that well elsewhere. I guess it was just purely for creative reasons, perish the thought.
I think James kind of speaks towards the kind of a key, which is the Western RPGs, they tend to be more sandboxy, whereas the JRPGs are more narrative focused.
I would actually say that Mass Effect sort of leans towards the JRPG side in a lot of ways.
Yeah, well, that's the thing, right? Like, there's basically, when we think of Western RPGs, we think of either BioWare or the other dudes.
Bethesda.
And BioWare, I think, is more story-focused with predetermined characters. Like Knights of the Old Republic, I mean, you had, what, 7 characters, perhaps, possible for your party, and they all had their own, I don't know.
They're like classes, builds, essentially.
Yeah,
like
they came with their old, like, preloaded personality, you know, right. Like, you could interact with them. And so, yeah, like, I guess... Even in the Western RPG part of it, like, there's different philosophies, you know?
Yeah.
And Bethesda is more, like, open world. They're more like Black Isle back in the day with Fallout. That's how that was my first Western RPG. And, you could basically go anywhere. You had very little direction and, go nuts, go explore the wasteland.
Right. There may be a main narrative thread there, but it's not necessarily the primary driver of all the action.
Right. Whereas, like, something like Planescape Torment, it was very much, well, you're in the first area, you get out of it, and then you're in the city, and then you almost went through levels.
Right.
You know, like, it was very, very linear compared to what I had played before.
Yeah. And I think when I say with Mass Effect, it's pretty linear, and the build options are fairly limited, although you can do whatever you want to your face. Like, I think if you've played that, you just need to anime that up by about 200%, and you're basically at a JRPG at that point.
Mm-hmm.
So if you can make your Shep with just big spiky hair and big round eyes, you're 90% of the way there.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You just need more space dragons.
Now, in terms of what makes them fun with JRPGs, I think really if you're kind of a min-max or stat geek, I think JRPGs usually cater to that really, really well. Whereas Western RPGs are kind of more, are you more interested in exploring the world kind of thing and sort of interacting with it? You know, you see stuff like Skyrim, like people will do silly things, like they'll collect all the cheese that they can collect and put it into a house. You know, it's that same sandboxy kind of thing.
Right. Yeah, and the JRPGs, I mean, again, like there's more than one flavor of them. Like you've got the kind of more linear adventure, which would be perhaps Final Fantasy, where you've got you go through the story with these preset characters, or you've got stuff that's more old school, like Etrian Odyssey, where you build your party out of various parts, almost. Like, no one has personality. They're just going to be your tank and your healer, etc. And you build them up as you go along. You choose their skills, and there's basically nothing going on in terms of story. You know, you can go back to town, you can talk to the innkeeper and whatever, and yes, there's some sort of scenario, you're moving towards a goal, but how you get there is entirely up to you.
Right. They're very, very, ultimately, I think what we're getting at is they're very different things in general.
Yeah. But mm-hmm. I think that Xenoblade Chronicles is a good choice to start with. Like, if you like the big open world RPG, Xenoblade Chronicles is more linear than the Wii U game, but it's still pretty damn expansive, and it still gives you quite a bit of freedom to explore. And it's got, you know, as we've mentioned many times, like the combat system is very much MMO-like.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah, yep.
So right, I guess the question is whether Jim bought a new 3DS.
Yeah, because otherwise you can't play it.
Well, yeah. Unless you have a Wii U, then you can play it.
But I assume, given all the systems he hasn't played...
Yeah, I know. I'm just saying.
I'm just trying to think of the practical elements here. You know, he's considering Xenoblade, so I assume he's aware of, you know, whether or not he can buy it, hopefully. But, Bravely Default is much more classic JRPG. That's kind of its whole thing, is that it's, you know, riffing on classic Final Fantasy, but it's got those new conveniences in there. About, you know, changing the random battle occurrence rate or, you know, that kind of stuff. So, the speeding up the battle animations, the Brave and Default system itself, about the way you kind of substitute your turns and all that kind of thing. So I think it's a decent entry point for someone that's not absolutely familiar with JRPGs to try something that is... still very classically a JRPG.
Yeah, I mean...
it just makes some accommodations into mechanically.
But we've spoken about that game has some other less...
Hopefully, maybe Bravely Second would be a better option. I don't know. The demo just came out here. I've been playing that. But obviously, that doesn't really speak to...
No, because we walked away from the demo of Bravely Default thinking, this is the one.
Well, like, I've been playing RPGs for a long time. I started way before that game. But one of the games... Actually, the game that made me... appreciate Dragon Quest style RPGs more was actually Retro Game Challenge on the DS. It's kind of funny to say, but yeah, like Jim maybe doesn't know this game, but Retro Game Challenge was this kind of weird game compilation where you had this thread of this kid playing through these, you know, the early history of gaming, like system after system. It was this weird trip through a past history of video games that never really existed, because all the mini games or the retro games that are in the compilation are made up, right? And,
right.
Anyway, it's hard to explain, but there is towards the end of the game, you finally unlock this thing called Guardia Quest, which is, you know, absolutely a riff on Dragon Quest. And I had played Dragon Quest before and I enjoyed it enough, but I almost needed Guardia Quest to spell out to me exactly how to play a Dragon Quest game and why it's fun before I could actually appreciate it. You know, like at some point you get, I can't remember, like you can read the hint or strategy guides in the game, like it's really it's a weird concept, but eventually, like at some point, you read that you're not supposed to kind of grind and then, you know, forever and then go face the boss. You're supposed to try to make it as far as you can in a dungeon, and then when you die, you're warped back to the last save point with, you know, your gold has been halved, but you still should push on and try to, you know, keep trying to progress more and more. And I don't know, like I guess I had always been grinding forever in my RPGs, and that rubbed me, you know, of some enjoyment of them. And once I read that, I was like, oh, that makes sense, okay. And I tried to play it that way, and it was, yeah. I don't know, it made a certain brand of JRPGs more palatable to me.
Yeah, I learned that same trick, also not from Dragon Quest, I learned them from Pokemon, where it was, oh, you fainted. And then you, again, it's exactly the same thing. You lose half your money. You're back at the well, in this case, you go back to the Pokemon Center and you keep all your experience. So have at it again. Xenoblade Chronicles, especially, is pretty generous with dying. So that,
oh,
that's
yeah, yeah, it's, yeah.
That's I would say more so than its successor.
Yeah, even though I will say, I mean, with X, the Skell Insurance thing drove me crazy, but you can just get around that just by, you know, going back to your last save. Yeah, I mean, you bail back to the title screen and then load your last save,
or you just bail out of your Skell.
Yeah, true.
You can also do that, but
yeah. But I mean, like I was saying, the first game actually is more forgiving than
X. Yeah, that was the one that Jim's looking at. So yeah, I think it's I think that's a great candidate. Well, funnily enough, by the way, Guardia Quest is as much Dragon Quest as I've ever played. I still haven't got around to trying one yet. So I think this is going to have to be the year with the 2, 7, and 8. Coming out.
They're coming out soon. And
that was the problem, though. I always kept putting this like, well, people say like 4's good, but 5's coming out soon. And then, like, well, 6 is interesting, like, because that was really late Super Nintendo game. And then it's 7's out in Japan, so that'll be getting localized soon, right? And then, no.
Well, no. First, I just want to say Retro Game Challenge, like $25 on Amazon, so. Grab that. But also, Final Fantasy. Dragon Quest V is probably my favorite of the older ones. And I don't know if that is easy to find, but definitely before 4 or 6, I would go with 5. There's 9 on the DS.
I was going to ask about that, because it does do some of the elements that you'd expect from an opener game, from a more of a Western-leaning game, because it doesn't have the preset protagonist. You can kind of do your own build.
Right.
It's very quest-driven.
Right, eventually, very soon in the game, maybe 10 hours in, you've got the class system or the job system that opens up, and then you can customize your character a little bit more in terms of his abilities. The story is really loose. You can almost go anywhere pretty soon into the game. And I don't know, I remember spending like maybe 100 hours in Dragon Quest IX without finishing it. Yeah,
that was quite a common occurrence. Have you heard a whole bunch of people talk about that? I never got around to it, but obviously I heard Johnny talk about it, editing the show. I heard lots of other people on other podcasts playing it, and yeah, that's always the feel I got, is that people were quite happy to sink untold amount of hours into that game without
particularly driving to
the finish.
Right, and it didn't really happen because I don't know, I kind of a little bit got addicted to the alchemy thing in the game where you create new items by finding items in the world and combining them. But also it was just like a great little like pick up for 5 minutes and then put down kind of game.
That would be great digitally, wouldn't it, if they did a re-release? Yeah.
I don't think you'd want to play that on the Wii U.
No. I mean, obviously, for Jim at the minute, you'd be talking about getting the DS card, and you know, playing that. But I was just kind of thinking, Dragon Quest games all get re-released. One day it's gonna happen, hasn't it?
Yeah. There's a lot of I don't know. We spent some time here. Are there any? We kind of had the approachable JRPG question a couple weeks ago, so Jim probably heard that one.
Right.
Can anybody think of a good Western RPG that in the handheld space on the DS maybe? There's almost certainly not one on the 3DS, because more or less it's been sort of
abandoned by Western developers.
Yeah, exactly. That's the big problem.
Well, I mean, they weren't abandoned. They were never there, almost. I mean,
a little bit of flirtation really early on, but it was fast, wasn't it? What's it, Heroes of Ruin? I don't really know anything about that game, but
right,
wasn't that a
Diablo
thing?
Yeah, it's Diablo. It's not really RPG-ish.
Etrian is kind of like an old 80s era RPG in a lot of ways, but that's
like a wizardry kind of thing.
Yeah, and I'm not sure that's what he's, and even then, it's animated to hell and back.
Yeah, but personally, Etrian Odyssey 4 was my first Etrian Odyssey game, and I liked it way more than I thought I would. You know, I was never into the use graph paper to draw labyrinths kind of RPG back in the day, but Etrian Odyssey 4 is a really good introduction to that type of RPG. It eases you in.
Yeah.
I know that, James, you kind of struggled with Persona Q. I think that perhaps Etrian Odyssey 4 was a little bit better balanced.
Yeah. Oh, I played it. It's a lot better balanced. I think it's much less intent on, like, we have to have 25 dungeons so every so often, you know, Koromaru can find something and then you can have a 20-minute dialogue sequence about what he found.
Right.
The interesting part of the question for me is, you know, what do you find fun about them? You know, and if I have not been a sort of big JRPG guy, but I've played a few and I have enjoyed them. But one of the things I enjoy most in many cases has been like the atmosphere of the game, you know, and I don't know how much of that is really bound up in nostalgia or not, because I played just a few. Of the sort of 16-bit golden era JRPGs, you know, like Chrono Trigger, Secret of Mana. I didn't run the whole gamut of the Final Fantasies or Dragon Quest, anything like that. So I'm thinking for someone with the gaps in his experience, like whether, you know, that it would evoke like those kinds of feelings about the atmosphere of those games, you know, because I think that's really what's it's like the Chrono Trigger, obviously, we always mention as like an accessible RPG. And for me, that's got a really magical atmosphere, but it's difficult to disentangle, you know, would I feel the same way if I'd never played it originally and I was just coming back to, or, and not just that. Like, as you know, as Jim talks about, like, he pretty much just didn't, like, really play the Super Nintendo by the sound of it, you know, so...
Yeah, I mean, and I have to wonder if I would like Chrono Trigger more if I would have actually played it at the time it came out. Because, because, I mean, I played it, I mean, really, I didn't play through it until a couple years ago. On DS.
Is there any sort of evidence of this that's in audio form about your quest to complete Chrono?
Perhaps a couple years worth of evidence.
Maybe. I mean, it's probably lost to time. You know how that goes. But yeah, I often wonder because, I mean, like, I played it and I'm like, yeah, it's really good. But I mean, I don't love it. Like, most people are like, it's the best game ever. And I'm like, well, I mean, it's a really good RPG. It's a really good JRPG, but
the goofy dialogue and the characters and all that stuff, I think, still stands up.
I'm not debating it, but to me, it's like my favorite RPG probably ever is FF6, which I played at the time. That's probably why.
But I think it's interesting though. You've got the specifics where it's like, well, you did play this, well, you didn't play that one. But if you had, like, I think if you'd played, say, just using that dichotomy, Final Fantasy VI and Chrono Trigger, if you played one and then played the other decades later, I still think it's going to remind you of that. Even though, they're different games, they're different games, but the aesthetic, you know, the pixel art, the music, the Super Nintendo sound chip, I still think it's going to tap, even if it's not a literal, oh, I'm nostalgic about playing this game 20 years earlier or something.
Yeah, but see, for me, it's
into something there.
Yeah, I think it's the way the game looks. Chrono Trigger looks more like... You know, it looks Dragon Questy to me, which I've never been a huge fan of, and that's
Toriyama's art. Yeah, I get that. Now, for me, it's a bit more about the music. I gotta say, the square stuff at that time. The music's just sensational all the time. You know.
Absolutely.
So that's the thing. It's like I could play like Theater Rhythm on 3DS. And you know, play, you know, songs from Final Fantasy games that I've never played, probably never will play. And it still kind of hits me in this place in my brain, you know, that's definitely got something to do with nostalgia. And I'm just thinking for someone like Jim, that skipped all that, you know, that might be kind of a limitation to how much he can enjoy it in the same way. I still think, irrespective of your perspective on them, you know, they're really good soundtracks. They're really beautiful games in a lot of cases. So, you know, there's still like a lot of merit to be found in them.
Hey, so I know this is only part one of his question, but I want to throw this. I want to throw this out before we continue, and we need to continue. From a pen and paper RPG standpoint, there is Crimson Shroud on the 3DS.
Oh yeah,
of course.
That's great. Great. Bite-sized RPG and
find the episode or replay it, because otherwise you might not be able to beat the damn thing.
Yep.
All right. John, why don't you continue?
The second part of his question, just quickly, I'll paraphrase it. He's wondering about the Vita and if he should get it not as a replacement for his 3DS, but as a supplement. He's heard bad things about it, and he's just wondering what our take is on that.
I mean, the bad things you hear about the Vita is that the Vita is dead. Like we occasionally make jokes about the Vita because it was the home for basically like anime boob games, which there are a lot of, but there's a lot of those on 3DS too. It's just there was other stuff. As a product, I have lived without having a Vita, but I have a Vita TV. It's not quite the same. I'm working through some stuff. There are a lot of PSP kind of more hardcore RPGs out there that maybe would be worth looking at. Maybe looking at a Vita TV itself, even though those things are hard as crap to get. The biggest knock really on the Vita was its memory cards, which are now finally coming down in price as people are trying to clear them out.
Yep.
Because the memory cards aren't like they are for most game systems where it's like for saving your data. That is the primary data storage for the Vita. And they were prohibitively expensive.
Yep.
Right.
So.
Yeah, I don't have a Vita, but I do have a PSP. I guess my warning against buying a supplement to the 3DS is that there is already a shitload of RPGs on the 3DS.
especially if you work in the RPG angle. Yeah,
I don't know. Like, you might have a you might be putting a little bit too much on your plate. Like, because I have been doing. Like, the thing is, the PSP has really good RPGs, and on PSN you can get them for really cheap, and that's what I've been doing.
And you can get some old PlayStation 1 RPGs too.
Yeah, and you can do that on the Vita as well.
And you can do that on the Vita, yes. But the problem is that, you know, like you're like, oh, like Final Fantasy, you know, nine for $10 for $5, I'd be a fool to pass that up.
Yeah.
And then you buy it. And I've been doing that for several, like a dozen games. And it's like, well, I only paid, you know, like $50 for 1,000 hours of entertainment.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I thought that, like, I did that 5 years ago. And I still have 8,000 hours of entertainment
now
in front of me.
Now you have 3,000 hours of entertainment.
Yeah, I keep doing the same mistakes. But anyway, like it's just, I don't know. Like the Vita has good stuff. Persona 4 Golden. Well, Persona 4 is one of my favorite RPGs I played. So it does have stuff that you know, and, would be worth your time.
I haven't got a Vita yet. I've considered it. My impression, and you know, perhaps those of you probably more educated on this could, you know, like John could sort of tell me how close this is to reality or not. My impression is that the Vita has a load of stuff to play for it, but nothing you have to play on it. You see
what
I mean?
Absolutely. It's very...
Or that you can't get somewhere else.
Exactly. Yeah. That's what I mean. Yeah, exactly. But, you know, there's nothing there that's just like, well, you've got to buy the system for that because you can't get that. You know, either literally that game or something that's kind of a close substitute somewhere else. So, you know, it's just like, it seems like it could be a really cool device to have and to play a whole bunch of games. Obviously, when you talk about the retro stuff, you talk about the indie stuff, you know, but in terms of exclusive software, it's especially, you know, that's anything sort of outside of the Japanese niche that James was discussing earlier.
Yeah, I mean, that's
it's
it. I mean,
thin on the ground.
Before I would buy one, I would really research the games that are out for it and really determine whether or not there's a critical mass of games that you really want to play, because there's a lot of just obscure stuff on there that if people want those particular obscure games, they're going to absolutely love them. But
at the same time, it's also probably the best portable way to play old PSP games.
Oh, absolutely.
Like, I don't think I would go and buy PSP at this point. I would go with the Vita for the better screen.
Yeah, sure. But
for some reason, I find that it's perfect to play on a plane. It's just, I always use it over the 3DS just because it's perfect to kind of play for like a couple of hours and then sit down. The 3DS is more like my long-term kind of play around the house kind of thing. For some reason, my Vita only comes out when I travel. I don't know why.
It's the wife and the girlfriend is what you're telling me.
It is.
And on that, Greg, why don't you read the next email?
Okay, so Justin writes, what are your personal opinions of the recent censorship, quote, scandals, particularly regarding Xenoblade Chronicles X and the upcoming Fire Emblem games? Blogs seem to be hitting Nintendo hard over it. I personally buy Nintendo's localization rationale. When it comes to removing actual gameplay elements like it sounds like they're doing for Fire Emblem, I'd much rather them replace it with something more appropriate for the Western market than to remove it altogether. together. Overall, though, I think the fan reaction is completely overblown in most cases, and Nintendo is justified in the changes they make. Not having the ability to put a 13-year-old character in her underwear or change the breast size of characters is A-okay with me. Your thoughts on the matter? When are these changes simply localization? And when do they cross the line into censorship?
So, to give a little bit of background here, in case people have missed or forgotten, in Xenoblade Chronicles X, there's a handful of changes. One of them involved the fact that you could change the bust size on female characters. Instead, I think the default, they just went with huge. And then there's a bathing suit outfit that all the characters can wear, but in the Japanese version they made, Lin could not... Well, they put Lin in this really weird-looking thing that's vaguely bathing suit-shaped instead.
Hmm.
It looks like she's wearing metal cargo shorts. So I would say the issue is probably that it looks like she's wearing metal cargo shorts versus the actual fact they did it. It's the fact they did it kind of weirdly. For Fire Emblem Fates, the rub was that they had removed this mini game. So in the game, you can invite members of your party up to your treehouse you live in because you're the leader of an army who lives in a treehouse. And
we're through the looking glass here, people.
There was this Pokemon of Me inspired thing where their face showed up on the screen and you basically rubbed their head and then it made noises. And then you got a story sequence. And then it came out that had been removed in the Western release. And we were all kind of waiting for how Nintendo was going to handle that. But this got even weirder because it came out yesterday that actually you can do that, but only with your spouse. Which is just... I don't...
Yeah.
At this point, why take it out? If you're gonna leave it in at all, why mess with it? Like, is the idea that, well, you can't rub people you don't know... You can't rub someone who's not your wife's head. It's like... If you're going to leave it in, who cares?
Yeah. Well, you can see videos of it on YouTube, and sure, technically you're rubbing the character's head, but it really, I don't know, they react like you're rubbing something else.
They do, yes, but you're not. But that's my point, though. If you're gonna take it out, why, like, this kind of, like, just... weird hyper-focus, like, well, it's okay...
In this context, it's okay, but anything else is suggestive.
It's like, I mean, it's inconsistency to me is when I go like, wait, this is dumb. This is a dumb thing.
But I thought that one of the problems with the uncensored version, the Japanese version, is that you could also do it with certain, like, relatives and also underage characters.
I mean, I would imagine any person you can S rank, that's probably still the case. And I think you can S rank relatives. So I don't know that that's gone. I think it's just a matter of, like, they just filed it down to, but I don't know that for sure because the game obviously isn't out yet. Reviewers do have it, but, you know, there's stuff they can and can't say. And I don't know the embargo terms, but I think you can still S rank those people. So I don't know. It's weird. Like that one was particularly weird because you're dealing with this hyper Japanese game already,
right?
And you could have probably toned down the suggestiveness, but to do this weird thing where it's out. Well, actually, it's not out. It's back. Sorry. It's kind of weird. It's a lot weird.
Yeah, sort of a half measure.
It's weird, right? Like I
imagine it would go to the concern that Justin mentioned, though, about, well, you know, I'd rather they replace it rather than take it out altogether. Than maybe they just couldn't, so instead they kind of limited it to that it was at least sort of harder to get to in some way, and therefore maybe, you know, but more just like the people that want to use that are going to, and then the people that don't are just going to kind of be able to ignore it more easily. I don't know. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, so you could still get the sequences that came after the Rub Rabbits minigame. when you go up there, I think it just cuts straight to the little conversation sequence that followed the petting simulator and. Mm. Except for this apparently sub instance, it's just a weird way to handle this. Like,
mm-hmm. Well, it's also just a weird thing in the first place.
It is.
To be fair, they didn't.
Yes.
You know, don't imagine anyone asked for this. You know, like,
right. Yeah, that's one of the things, right? Like the story was written by one of the guys who wrote Senran. What's it called? Senran Kagura? Or
was it really?
Well, he was brought on board, yeah. Like he's got like credits for the game, but I don't think that he had a you know, he made a decision about the rubbing thing, but
to a certain extent, when we talk about this stuff, I'm kind of the position that, hey, this thing's from Japan. Japan is different. Like, and at some point, I understand the need to localize, but I also understand the need to contextualize that on the part of the player. And here's where I think, like, there's a game where it, Gennei Bunroku basically needs to come through untouched, because that game is about a very specific subculture in a very specific place in Japan.
It's like a talent school, right? Like the whole setup.
Yeah,
it's
a concept that exists there. And I think in that case, you really can't sanitize it. I think it just needs to come through as it is. And I think the localization team has a responsibility to contextualize, but a game that is so deeply driven on its context of being, this is effing Japan, yo, mm-hmm. that your hand needs to be incredibly light. And I think if it comes out that game's been all tweaked and stuff for localization, I think that's much more reprehensible.
I don't know, some of it, my feelings on this in general, first of all, just on the specific examples, I don't care. I'm not going to feign like outrage one way or the other. I think they're fairly trivial. But in general, you know, these sorts of questions, you know, if, say, for instance, if he was talking about films, you know, like, for instance, like some old Italian horror films I've watched by Mario Bava or Dario Argento, like, I will want to watch the original Italian version, you know, as close to just what the director originally envisioned as possible, because it's like that's what you want to see, the creative intent.
Right.
Sort of as pure as possible. I can understand the argument that it's like, well, you know, this is whoever, you know, whether it's the guy that wrote Senran Kagura or whoever, yeah, it's like, it is.
Dubs versus subs is what it's like.
Yeah, I mean, that's part of anime. It. You know, just like, I just want to get, like, you know, the vision as they originally had it as closely as possible, you know, without, like, somebody else kind of, you know, maybe kind of getting in there and twist it the right way or something, you know, just kind of experiencing it unfiltered like that. I kind of get that instinct, but I mean, the whole censorship thing for me is a little bit different, because a lot of this is just business decisions, you know. A lot of this is Nintendo are choosing to make choices about the game that they think will make it get better feedback and sell better, you mm-hmm. know, which is not about, that's not, you know, there's nobody with, you know, the long arm of the law, you know, pointing a gun at their head saying, you've got to take this out, you've got to take that out, that's a whole other kind of thing for me.
In their case, no, but there probably are some games where the ESRB does that quite explicitly, because, I mean, if you go back and read the article Johnny wrote about the process, I mean, it's really checklisty. Like, is this in there? Well, you just get bumped up to this other rating.
Yeah, and of course, and that affects your commercial prospects, possibly, depending on what kind of game it is. In some cases, you know, very obviously, it's the kind of game that would be an 18 or whatever anyway, so being an 18 doesn't really affect, you know, doesn't really make much difference. But in other cases, you know, it might not be. You might think it would hurt sales if I accept that there is, you know, kind of a line somewhere where it could cross into that. I'm not sure that's necessarily what's at play
in this case, no. But I would say
especially
that,
especially to the point that it's still in the game, it's just
that's what makes it so nuts.
I think we could kind of cast that. So that, I think this is more of a cultural localization thing, where it's like, okay, mm-hmm. well, you know, like, it just, people might get distracted by just the weirdness of, like, well, you're just touching any. Anybody. But if you've built S level affinity with someone, you get physical intimacy is part of your everyday routine.
I would say that the in this case, it doesn't really, it's not what we're dealing with here. But at the same time, there is kind of a weird thing that Fire Emblem is basically a game about you committing mass murder on just a regular basis. I mean, you are essentially creating just mindless killing machines. So there is a weird, like, violence versus weird sexual stuff that came in play here that we have to deal with, this kind of the cultural divide again.
That's a very much an American sort of cultural element, isn't it? Where, you know, sort of anything, you know, kind of sexual is going to be a lot more sensitive than people getting killed in their dozens or hundreds or whatever.
Whereas Hector literally killing 70 dudes in one mission.
Whereas in other countries, you know, there are different sensitivity issues. Obviously, Germany historically has been very sensitive to the violent stuff, you know, to sometimes result in some hilarious censorship. Oh, yeah.
These are now robots.
Yeah.
Right. You know. Yeah, in Carmageddon, you now pop balloons or kill zombies.
Yeah. Yep.
It's like, so to Greg's point, there are definitely business considerations in here. I do come down a little bit on the side of preserving the artistic vision. And
as a general rule, with all media that I consume, that's probably would be my... If it was just me, if somehow, you know, you could order the game, like, ad hoc, and just localize it for me and me only, I would just do it pretty straight. But, you know, to be fair, sometimes, you know, that might actually kind of... rob it of a bit of the personality that localizers bring to, you know. I think sometimes you kind of underestimate how much they do actually inject into it, you know. I mean,
sure.
Especially with certain games, they probably, you know, really do enrich it for
Ace Attorney, for example, where they just went nuts and just said, no, this is now North America, except in France, where this is now France.
Yeah, and in some cases, like, it is. You know, I think when I think of censorship in video games, I think more of the older Nintendo and like replacing the crosses by whatever in Castlevania and stuff like that. I think
releasing Devil World at all. Like, that's kind of weird. Yep. Like, that would have been really easy to ROM hack out all that stuff. But they brought it out in Europe because we're heathens? I don't know.
Yeah, kind of. I mean, to put it in your perspective, though, it's still business because they just didn't want to deal. They didn't want to deal with the controversy that could come out of it.
Yeah, that's the thing. Right. I think that's where people get concerned is the idea that, you know, sometimes, you know, business decisions, you know, can be sort of de facto censorship because there'd be so much negative publicity that it would affect the business. So, like, it's not as easy to just kind of sector off, oh, well, this is a business decision, so, you know, it wasn't a case of, like, you know, some, you know, nanny state type of thing or, you know, people kind of lobbying to get it removed. But sometimes they could just anticipate that before it happens. And that's where it's like, well, you know, are we meant to be sort of psychic somehow and sense why they made the decisions they made?
Yeah.
You know, that's where it's really getting tough, you know, because
sometimes it just feels like, because, you know, I translate for a living, and sometimes it just feels like common sense. It feels like, well, I should really change this turn of phrase because it sounds bad, you know, it sounds really, really bad, and I'm doing them a favor by turning it another way. It's a fine line to walk, but sometimes you just, you know the culture. When you translate into your culture, right? And you know your own culture better than whoever you're translating from.
Language and culture inextricably linked. I mean, that's yes. Part of the issue.
Yeah, I mean, like, we translate into Canadian French here, not, you know, France French, because there's a difference, you know, not the same terms, but also not the same culture, not the same...
Right.
Not the same things are acceptable.
Yeah, I mean, so you don't... That's why you normally hire someone to translate into their native language, not out.
Right.
Because you have that... Even if it's not your native language, you still have... You're still influenced by what your native language was, even if you're perfectly fluent.
Mm-hmm.
So you may not... To Gabe's point, you may not notice something that comes out weird, because to you, in your brain, it still makes sense.
Right, and some of the worst... I don't know, most of the time, when you think of the worst dialogue or the worst localizations, you can trace it back to the Japanese director insisting on... Like they think that they know English, and
yeah,
they insisted on certain things to be said a certain way.
That's kind of something that's frequently leveled at Other M. I don't know how true it is, but it's very believable.
Yeah.
Why am I frying over the jungle?
I would say, though, you know, obviously it's funny that you should mention this whole thing about that, though, even with fluent speakers or something, because I guess, like, the surefire way to be able to experience it the way the creators originally intended is to, like, learn their language, I guess, you know, and actually play that version. But, you know, what James is saying is, like, even then, it's still not quite there, is it? You know, you're still
not... Yeah, because you didn't grow up in the culture, right?
Right.
Yeah, so... It's just, you know, that's life, I guess, at a certain point. You know,
even if you grew up natively speaking that language, if you grew up in, like, I don't know, on the Ryukyu Islands, and then you're playing a game based in Tokyo, like, it's not going to be the same. Like, it's different.
Yeah.
You know, it's just because you grew up in Japan, like, or grow, let's say you grew up in like the mountains, in you know up in the north where it snows a lot, like in Sapporo. Like, it's not going to be the same as playing a game set in Tokyo where there are dialectal differences, sure, but like it's just a different culture.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah, granted, you have exposure to it because of TV, but still, it's a different thing.
Yeah, immersion is tough to achieve, especially, I guess, with Japanese culture. But like, even in my case, like for 20 years, I've been kind of immersing myself in U.S. culture, and I still don't get most of the references that some people make, you know, like for some certain cartoons from people's childhoods or whatever. Like, I grew up watching different things, and I'm still, you know, there's still references that I don't get. And this is U.S. culture. Like, you guys export it. Like,
yeah,
it's not hard to get your hands in a Hollywood movie, you know?
Yeah. And you're only a few hours drive from the U.S. itself anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I can imagine difficulty in kind of really understanding Japanese culture.
So I would say that the true villain here isn't Nintendo. It's the people who write articles to get controversy. And on that, next email. We don't know who's going to read it. So I'm going to read the next email, actually. Christopher writes, "Dear RFN crew, hearing people swoon over the idea of a Zelda Maker in the vein of Mario Maker makes me want to punch all nearby monitors and or podcast playing devices. As an editor, Mario Maker benefits from being incredibly immediate, but also diverse in how the pieces can interact with each other. Zelda Maker could have potential for the player, but it's hard to even imagine it being fun as an editor. Is there any way you could see a Zelda Maker working well? What other Nintendo franchises could even fit the Maker duality of creation and play? A Kirby Maker? A Mario 3D Maker? Mario Kart Maker? Or just sell a $1,000 3D printer accessory and have Amiibo Maker?"
Wow.
How about Scarf Maker? We'll just go with that and we'll call the episode. Are we done?
Done.
Sure. Yeah, well, they just have to bring back that NES knitting device where you could create patterns on the TV screen and then it would knit it for you. There you go.
Yep. So
yeah, I don't know. I think it's a good point. Like, not only I think it would be hard to make a Zelda Maker fun to create with, but it would also be really hard. Like, if you think that Mario levels are not very good, like, can you imagine the bad Zelda dungeons that would come out of this?
And that's about as far as you could take it. Also, I mean, there's not really much room for, like, you know, having any sort of narrative, which all those games are predicated on, you know?
Yeah, more or less, yeah. I'm not sure if I play Zelda for the story.
But even more than that, an overworld that connects with all these places. I mean, it would have to be, you'd have to make, to have any chance of it working in terms of, you know, being manageable for some level of players, you'd have to sort of pare it back more substantially than Mario Maker does. Obviously, Mario Maker does make concessions. We've talked about some of those in the past, but it still feels a hell of a lot like Mario when you're playing it most of the time. Whereas with Zelda, like I said, those concessions will have to be more serious, and then you start to wonder, you know, what is it really intact at that point? I mean, I think it probably would get a subset of really, you know, talented people could do cool things with that if it did exist. But the problem is, if it's going to really kind of work, you've got to have it sort of be fun for more than just those people that have the talent and the concentration and the dedication to kind of work it through to create something as kind of demanding as a Zelda dungeon, if that's what it was.
Right.
So part of the appeal of Mario Maker is kind of bringing elements from other Mario games into an older Mario game that didn't have that theme. And I'm just trying to rack my brain, like, what would a Zelda Maker use as themes? You know, like Game Boy, Super Nintendo,
Minish Cap.
NES. And it's like, okay, from there, what? Like, is it really that difficult to imagine what the boomerang of would do, like it would look like in 16-bit and 8-bit, like it was in all the games.
Right.
Gus Jar in 8-bit Zelda.
Yeah.
Is that exciting?
I don't know.
The one thing that I would say, and, you know, I thought about this because it was kind of the immediate reaction to Mario Maker coming out and being good.
Right.
Because you remember, before it came out, we were all kind of like, well, I hope it's good. Because I think on this show we were like, well, Nintendo's going to screw this up here's a list of ways they could screw this up. I don't know which way they're going to do it, though. And when it came out, and I think we all kind of said, okay, they didn't really screw this up. Sort of the immediate refrain was like, oh, man, I can't wait for a Zelda maker. And I was kind of with Christopher. I was kind of thinking, like, I don't see it.
Nah,
but the more people said it, I was like, okay, well, maybe I'm just not seeing it.
Now, I think it might be more interesting as the 3D version of it would be more interesting.
So the thing that I'd
still
point
dungeon out, based, but
the thing that I'd point out is that there's Kaizo Mario is a thing. It is a thing that's been around for a while, but you don't see that with Zelda. And right. I think part of the reason is in Mario you move in two dimensions, and in Zelda you move in two dimensions, but you're doing it very differently. Link is very much stuck on the floor, and he's just sort of moving through his space. Whereas Mario, you're moving through kind of the world feels bigger, essentially, because you're going up and down and left and right. You're not going in and out, but doesn't seem to matter as much. So, like, you can feel like you can experiment with the world more fully, because it exists on, you know, height plane versus just sort of an above ground view.
Maybe a Zelda 2 maker. What do you think of that?
Yeah, but people didn't play Zelda 2. That's the problem. Why don't we just say like an Adventures of Zork maker? It was just screw it. I don't care. It's right. just a text editor. Have fun.
Adventure of Lodo.
Yeah, great. It's a Mappy Land maker. Have a good time, everybody.
Cuber maker.
Yeah, there you go. You know what it is? It's just stairs every single time. Every stage is the same. You have no control over it. You just say, make a stage, and it makes the stage. And then you post it to the internet, and it's just like every other stage.
Oh, brilliant.
Yeah. You know, it's the challenge with other makers, if you're trying to think of a franchise where it works, is it works so well in Mario. But we already knew it did, because we've already seen, like I said, we've already seen these Mario ROM hacks. These have been a thing for a long time.
Yep.
The challenge.
But even then, though, I would say I think Nintendo probably exceeded my expectations a little bit in how fun they could make the actual process, you know, from a very practical point of view of putting a level together. And obviously the Wii U hardware's got a lot to do with that. You know, the gamepad, I think, is kind of integral to that process. So, you know, you might not, back when, you know, you're thinking of ROM hacks way before the Wii U even existed, you wouldn't necessarily been envisioning that part of it. But so, I mean, I guess it does have that on its side, you know, and the Wii U might be gone by the time
right.
any subsequent maker games come along, or if they were to, and yeah, we don't know what NX is going to be like, as you know, say every week.
Yeah.
So yeah, but I don't know. I just feel like that is the biggest barrier. That creation's got to be fun, and I think I'm sure there's probably are like, you know, people have like hacked old Zelda games to make some like really devious like dungeons online or whatever. Maybe not in the same kind of numbers that you had with platformers or whatever, but I just think that kind of reflects the reality that it would just be a very few probably people that could actually kind of get the most out of it. And at
right.
that point you've got to wonder what's going to be the appeal of it for everyone, you know, just like, well, for the, I mean, he says in the email, you know, about, well, perhaps it would be great for the people playing it, but I'm still don't know whether it would feel like a must-have.
I think it'd be bad for both.
I don't know whether it would feel like a must-have product, you know. It's like, well, maybe there'd be a cadre of, you know, really kind of clever people doing great things with it. But, you know, without it being kind of that critical mass that where it's going to be, like, shared all over the place on the internet for people to see it, I think a lot of players might be just like, yeah, I'll just, you know, if I can't really feel like I'm going to be able to make any kind of progress or fun, have any fun with the editor, I may as well just play, you know, an old Zelda game or wait till the next one comes out or whatever. You know, like, I just, yeah, I don't even really see it so much from the player side as Christopher does.
I think the challenge here is that a Zelda dungeon, a properly designed Zelda dungeon, is an organic thing where you flow from place to place and you sort of build on the experience. You go to place A, you get the key, you go back to where you started, then you go to B, and you're sort of gaining skills. You know, you literally gain skills, and then you gain skill with whatever item you've collected to allow you to sort of see a place, then come back and solve the problem once you've got the item or know how to use it better. I think with the Mario thing, it's a much more immediate you versus the stage. Now, there are some very devious levels that have been created by people where you have to kind of manipulate items throughout the stage. Greg made one with the shell. What'd you call that stage?
Which shell was this?
There was the one. There was the stage where you had to carry the items around.
Oh, is that the keep your chin up?
Yeah, yeah. Like there are
people. It's just all about that mechanic from Mario World, basically. That you're
right.
Because that was the one that let you kick things in the air. So that was
right.
That's the idea. When he's looking up, his chin is all the way up. For, you know, because he has to camp it up directly. He's looking up. So
there are people who have made stages taking that idea a lot farther, like picking up the P switch and carrying it back to the start of the level to hit that to get something else. And or taking POW blocks around and doing kind of stuff like that.
Kind of retraversal elements almost, which is more like a sort of Zelda dungeon
right.
type of feel, or you know, maybe even a Metroid type of feel. Although with Metroid, it tends to be more kind of macro,
broad,
you know,
right?
Like, it, you know, it's because you're talking about an entire world that's interconnects and all that. It's not so obviously Zelda dungeons tend to be, you know, more self-contained, and then a Mario level literally is just self-contained.
Right. It's very moment to moment on a Mario stage, and I think my concern is that there are a handful of people who push the Mario Maker tool to do that, and that's really cool. Mm-hmm. But I think ultimately what you would run into is that the majority of users don't have the skill set to kind of think laterally and build this thing where you could play through it. And I think
think it's even just the skill set. I think it's how
the
many
patience.
Would find it enjoyable to do it. That's the key. Is that you know?
Yeah.
I think that's the thing about Mario Maker making the process more fun is that it's essentially sort of. Drills deeper down into the fan base in terms of the number of people that actually will take the time to create stuff because it doesn't feel like work so much.
Well,
you know,
I mean, part of that too is the fact that Mario games have a whole bunch of crazy items where it's part of the fun is just seeing how they interact with each other. Right?
So what if you just had Gus Bellows Maker?
I'd double dip.
There you go.
On the Mario Kart thing, though, I mean, it does. Yeah, I would like to see more of their racing games have designer course. That, you know, I mean, you think back to F-Zero X where they wanted to do it and then ended up doing it in the DD expansion and all that. Mm-hmm. I mean, and of course, they did have the X Cup with the procedurally generated courses, which could create some hilarious results. You know, so I don't know. I feel like that's kind of. Gone underutilized by Nintendo for a little while.
Yeah, but that's just a track editor. Like that's not you wouldn't build the game around.
I mean, I'm not saying like you like create the racing mechanics or anything like that. It would just be a track editor. But you know, I think hopefully the fact they seem to be, you know, because for a long time, you know, it's kind of like a number of things with Nintendo. They seem to be pretty kind of. You know, reticent about user-generated content, but over, you know, quite a while now, you know, I guess you could go back to WarioWare DIY and stuff like that. They've really started to, you know, embrace it a lot more, and it would be nice to have those sorts of, if God forbid they ever did another F-Zero game, I'd quite like to see what crazy crap people could come up with for a track and layout.
So the problem with this one is it's a bit more niche, but what about a game where I think the maker almost has to be a 2D game? Because I think when you have to design 3D spaces, the tool set.
Yeah, when he says Mario 3D Make, I don't see that at all. No.
Because you need to be able to manipulate the game world.
I know. The thing is, like, something like Kirby Maker, I think, you know, it's, I mean, you could do it, but is it just.
What about Metroid Maker?
Commercially, is it just redundant, you know, when you've got Mario, which is just the more popular platformer?
Or when you've got Kirby games coming out on the reg, too.
Yeah, you could possibly do it with Metroid, I would think.
Yeah, I think Metroid has the Zelda problem, though.
That macro thing that I talked about, though, is the problem there in terms of the true essence of Metroid, you know, that style of game when it's done right, is that
true.
Feeling of the world being organically designed such a way that, you know, you explore it a number of different times, but in a number of different ways.
Yeah, it doesn't lend itself to just one-offs like Mario does.
Right.
Yeah, again, you'd have to make some pretty significant concessions and sort of, you know, drawing in the scope of it, I think.
Yeah.
Game hurts it even more than Zelda does.
Yeah, I think. So, I mean, again, it's kind of, there's certain aspects of it think that's a cool possibility, but I can't see it in other
what
ways.
About like so this is where I'm trying to think of what games Nintendo has that are either 2D or 2D-ish and like what kind of mechanics would work. So a lot of what makes Mario interesting as a game, both as the maker when you're making a stage and as a player, is the prospect for the maker to surprise the player. Like, that's a lot of where the game comes from. And when you hear Nintendo people talk about making games, they talk about providing surprise or however they choose to word it at that moment. And one of the things that I'm trying to think of franchises they have that work on the concept of surprise. And like,
yeah,
something
like
they
already did WarioWare, which was perfect for it in many ways. I think the problem with that was probably just the sharing, you know, like it could be done. There was a WiiWare app and all that, but
Guillaume, you're actually not far from where I'm going though.
Really?
Luigi's Mansion, like
bing ding. Because think about it, they give you the pieces, you build the stage, and you can hide the stuff in it. But here's the thing, I just don't see the commercial appeal.
Yeah.
Although Luigi's Mansion 2 on 3DS sold really well, but user created one probably not. So, because the jump scares, so you're like, you know, you could hide silly scares, like, you know, to get people,
but
you know,
you could hide puzzle solutions and stuff, you know, they have to interact with the items, and maybe a ghost pops out, maybe like the item they're looking for comes out. You could still have locked doors. I think you could build small dungeons pretty easily because the game does sort of compartmentalize itself into these sections.
Yeah, I mean, you could do it like, you know, you're effectively building a haunted house. So
I think it would be kind of fun to build a haunted house.
Yeah, I mean,
I guess
it
probably is. Well,
you'd have to augment it a bit, but
could you actually 2D-ify it, you know, to actually pair it back to 2D to do it and still get the kind of feel?
The problem is, the problem is that everyone knows what pieces you can put in your haunted house, though.
But everybody knows what pieces you can put in your Mario stage.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Still, though, when they interact, weird things can happen. I don't know whether it would necessarily
I think you could build some interaction. I mean, there's a lot, like, there's a lot of items. There's coins. You could put in power-ups or whatever. You could put in different types of ghosts and how the ghosts interact with certain items. You could have them possess items, which does happen in the game, just not very frequently. You know, like you say, if you put this type of ghost in there, that item becomes an enemy and moves around in certain ways after you interact with it, then you have to get it out. Like, I'm struggling to franchises that have the potential for surprise, and that one is one that really jumps out at me.
Yeah, I think where you're right about the commercial aspect figures is just that, you know, with Mario, it's something that we all kind of know, you know, it's a formula, if you like, a template that we all recognize, we all know. And to some extent, you know, I think there's a legitimate case we made that, you know, for older people, like, they probably have thought about making levels before. They probably looked at your level layouts in a guide in a magazine or something, and do doodles of level layouts and stuff like that.
Absolutely.
You know, whereas, you know, Luigi's Mansion doesn't have that kind of mind share or heritage or anything like that. I think that's the problem, isn't it? There's just, I think, as wonderful as Mario Maker is in so many ways, I don't see it as a repeatable. I mean, they can iterate on Mario Maker itself and, you know, take it to the next platform and maybe put some new things in, or like we've talked about that before, but in terms of like actually, okay, let's take the Maker thing to other genres or this kind of stuff, I think it's going to be difficult to replicate that success.
Yeah, cool. At most I see basically editors, level editors in games, like they already do with the Mario vs. Donkey Kong franchise.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, they've been doing that for ages. Were they going to have it in the GBA version at one point, and then ultimately for some reason it wasn't there? But yeah, I mean, they've been doing that with that series for ages.
Golgo 13 Maker.
Earthbound Maker.
Somebody's got to make it, right?
James. Instant reaction.
You're right. I could make the first good Earthbound game.
I set you up for that. You're welcome.
This is hard. Like, so certain genres just require such a big commitment. Like, there is a tool called RPG Maker. It's a really awesome tool. I've used it. Like, you can get way deep in there, but that's not going to have mass market appeal.
Yeah.
Racing games, you don't really want to be surprised in a racing game. That kind of sucks.
Yeah, and there's also a ceiling to really what you can do with that.
Right.
Creatively.
Fighting games, you can really only create stages, because when you create fighters, they're really just sort of remixes of existing pieces.
Yeah.
Like I would actually really like a Metal Slug Maker, personally, but I understand that's like a weird, like, that's a weird, like, fetishization of games I really enjoy, or a Mega Man Maker, but
but again, that exists on the PSP.
Yeah,
Mega Man Powered Up has a has that. And of course, they were going to do, like, they were going to kind of expand on that, weren't they, with that game that got, what was it called? Mega Man Universe? What was it called?
Yeah. Universe. Oh, you're right.
Universe, right, and
yeah,
they
that got
yeah.
canned.
That
yeah.
only existed as a live action claymation trailer.
Yeah, with, like, bad box art, Mega Man, and all that weird stuff. And
Capcom's
Ryu
the
and,
worst.
Yeah.
But, like, but here's, I mean, we limit ourselves to Nintendo, but do we think, like, an old NES player would be willing to let Nintendo use their license? I mean, Mario Maker sold a lot of copies. Like, would it be possible that Nintendo could get Capcom on the hook for making this? Like, look, we'll make it. We'll give you a cut. And somebody will finally make a good Mega Man game in the last decade. And everyone will be happy. And you'll probably also beat Mighty No. 9 to market still, so you're good.
Okay, last decade includes 9 and 10, which I do
yeah,
like.
Those
well,
are good.
Well, those games are old now, though. They're
old, but they're under 10 years old.
Yeah,
well,
they're from the 80s.
Fine, by the time that comes out, they probably won't be.
Well, yeah, if we're talking Mighty No. 9 timeline.
Well, no, but I said it will come out, so we're not talking the Mighty No. 9 timeline.
Sure, yeah.
I don't know, like, that. Like, you'd want to be a franchise that's evolved a lot over time, and that one certainly has evolved a lot over time. You know, I was playing Zero last night, and you compare that all the way back to, like, NES Mega Man. Those games don't feel like at all.
Yeah, that might be too broad. I think you'd have to rein in a little bit.
You would have to, yeah. But, I mean, there's mm-hmm. there's lots of options there you can play with. You could say the same for Castlevania, but...
I think Castlevania, you know, is something that sort of, you know, comes to mind for me just because, you know, classic Castlevania hasn't been done for so long. Because even, you know, long before, like, we got to Lords of Shadow and all that, you know, it got usurped by the Metroidvania, you know, the Egavania
right.
games.
I guess Rebirth is the last
yeah,
game?
Yeah, Rebirth was actually pretty good, you know, not the prettiest game, but certainly not very original, but you know, like I said, we hadn't had that kind of game for so long, and we haven't had it since. So
what would a Simon's Quest maker just do? Would you just, like, character has to sit still for 30 seconds, boat shows up. Just, like, how would you script this nonsense? You have to jump in place 31 times, but not 32. Then you get killed by Dracula immediately. It's like, how would you make that game?
Yeah, that'd have to be lit. Much like
color
Mario
palette has more than browns, blues, and whites.
Much like
Sorry.
Mario 2, that would have to be eliminated from the planet.
I don't know. Are there any other franchises that have been around a while that have seen those kinds of changes? That
I think a Makai Mura Maker, just firstly for the phonetic possibilities, but also just because, well, obviously, you know, we don't have to worry about complaining that all the user-created levels are hard because the original series is evil personified anyway.
Let's move on.
All right, fine. We'll move on. Last email. Who hasn't read an email?
I haven't.
Guillaume, read an email.
Thomas writes, "Hi, RFN crew. I wanted to hear your thoughts regarding what I believe to be significant changes in Nintendo's messaging since the death of Iwata. I feel like the company has grown quieter and more conservative in its messaging, especially in terms of announcements and Nintendo Directs. From the end of June through the beginning of February, we have seen only one Nintendo Direct and one Smash Brothers presentation. This is a sharp decline from previous years. I have increasingly seen rumors, leaks, and speculation filling the void. How do you see these changes affecting Nintendo, its fans, and sites like Nintendo World Report?"
So I would say first off that if you still want to get our opinion after the last two episodes of emails, I question whether or not you're thinking this through. Because at one point last week, the smartest thing said was in the email sent to us about an electric toothbrush. But, so for the rumors thing, this has come up before. There were a goddamn ton of rumors around the Wii when that thing was an unknown quantity, mm-hmm. when it was still the revolution. The reason you probably didn't see it is because we knew everything there was to know about the 3DS and the Wii U. Well before those things were announced.
Right. Yeah, like, I think that the sharp decline in information has very much to do with the fact that there's a sharp decline in Wii U and 3DS releases. There's not that much to announce for them, and they're not ready yet to announce their NX stuff. And they're waiting for E3.
And Nintendo's done a much better job not letting that stuff leak out this time.
Well, right. Like I said, though, there are quite a few leaks and things that happen. Not so much like humongous things, but I think, you know, what Thomas is talking about, you know, we touched on when they did have that one direct, you know, in the time frame he's talking about. which certainly was a pretty significant decrease in frequency, where, it's like, well, oh, they could, all these things they could talk about that we already had heard, about Dragon Quest localization. Well, Yuji Horii spoiled that when he was in France and this, that, and the other, that just felt like, there were so many announcements that probably could have made earlier that they hadn't been. That, there were fewer surprises as a result, and we're getting into a little bit of that now. We've got a situation with these Mother 3 rumors about, seems like,
yep.
Obviously the cats over at NWR have got the inside scoop on that it's, Mother 3's coming. But even outside of the absolutely rock solid source of the cats, you see it elsewhere, and it seems like that's going to happen. I wasn't all that confident it would happen, because as encouraging as Earthbound Beginnings was, that game was localized for sure. We already knew it had been localized decades earlier, whereas we never really knew how far they ever got into localizing Mother 3, if at all, if they ever really considered it. So it was always a bit more of a leap, but it looks like it's happening. And, if and when it does, then it isn't going to be as much of a surprise, is it?
Right.
So I think Thomas has a point. And I think, definitely what Guillaume says is part of it, that there's a kind of a wind down going on because of the cycle. Mm-hmm. And obviously this is the first cycle where we've really had the kind of Nintendo Directs being such a big part of it all the way up until now. But the other part I would say is that, you have this kind of situation where they kind of took a bit of a pause after Iwata's death, very understandably, as we talked about at the time. Obviously that was a very, shocking and sobering and sad event. And then, so they're going to want to give that the proper space and take some time to reconsider. Obviously they didn't know even who was going to take his place straight away and all sorts of things to sort out. And now that, we have sorted out the hierarchy and all that, they've had one, but then they kind of said then that, well, we're kind of thinking about a fresh look at what approach we're really going to have with them from now on. So I still feel like it's more just kind of a something of a vacuum, mm-hmm. because they haven't quite got their feet under them yet in terms of how they want to, deal with this kind of stuff from now on. And then when you add that to what Guillaume says about the fact that, there's kind of, there is less stuff to talk about because it's getting more NX focus and they don't want to talk about that yet, for various reasons, not all of which are apparent. We don't know how much of it is because they've got like crazy, innovation up their sleeves, or it's just their usual secrecy. But I think the point there is that they will be, I think they will get a bit more back up to speed, but it might be in a bit of a different form than it was before.
Yeah,
eventually.
I mean, this is going to sound funny saying this, but do not underrate the death of Iwata and the impact that that has on the company as a whole. I mean, that's a huge deal. I mean, Iwata was obviously not just some stuffed shirt. His death would, kind of change the entire course of the company for years to come.
Right. He was the co-number one setting the path for their software development.
Yep.
He was the singular number one setting the path for the corporate culture. He was arguably their number one spokesperson.
Yep.
And the Nintendo Direct, the Iwata asks, the way that they present information was very much being shaped by his perception of what he wanted the company to be.
Yeah.
And you can see it. Like, you can see this sort of, he never came off as sort of, I don't want to use the word flighty, but as not strange, but that's kind of the word I'm going for.
Eccentric,
as kind of,
maybe?
Yeah, as Miyamoto does. He always came off more suited. But then you would see these scenes of just, he was in on the joke too. You'd see him wearing a giant Mario hat, but still in a suit and a vest, like a three-piece suit. Or you'd see him holding out his hands, and eventually he got in on the joke of his hand gestures to the point where there was the puppet of him holding the bananas staring at them.
Yeah.
Like he knew. Yeah. Like he was kind of a weird dude in his own right. And he had a sense of humor about him. So those things are extensions of his vision. And I think ultimately that with his loss, it makes sense that they dial back and say, okay.
There's no one-for-one replacement. That's
right.
Yeah, it's not, I mean, it hasn't even been a year since he died. I mean,
it's not like he was directing the Nintendo Directs. But, I mean, they were being made to please his sensibilities.
No, and it just built up around it. It does, James sort of mentioned the sort of evolution of it. You know, it did build up over time.
Right, those first ones were very dry.
And then it stops, and, you know, with his death, you know, sadly, and now, you know, I think they're kind of thinking about how you're going to really kind of restart it again.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess the other thing is, though, you know, outside of the direct thing, it's going to be interesting, because we've got used to Nintendo not, you know, kind of having the stage show at E3
right.
at this point, because the last cut you've had the digital event. But... Yeah, you know, if they're talking about unveiling a new system, you know, that has got a whole bunch of different questions, because you know, they have unveiled those at state. You know, the last systems, you know, the newest ones on the market, 3DS, Wii U,
well...
you know, that was still when they were doing stage shows. And, you know, obviously when those happened, you know, Iwata was very front and center with that. Whereas,
was
you
it,
know...
though? Because the Wii U, they did wasn't that done at the pre-E3 Direct? Where they went, they did the rundown of the system, and because then they were going to show us all the hot games, and it was Nintendo Land. Because there was a direct.
Well,
before
they did the. I'm thinking like 2011. You know, before 2012. You know, that year where they spoke about Smash Brothers, like really general stuff. But you know, they've still we had the name, you know, and things like that. So there was some sort of unveiling there. It was pretty thin on the ground, but there were demos. You know, there was stuff like that. So
Right. Yeah, I was there. What the f?
Okay. You know, so that's what I'm thinking of. You know, 2011
E3
for Wii U, and 2010 E3 for 3DS.
Yeah, you're right.
You know, that sort of, so those are quite a while ago now, and I'm just thinking, you know, in terms of this messaging point, you know, I mean, even if Iwata was still alive, there would still be a question of, well, are we going to sort of go back to the stage show to unveil hardware because that's different, you know, but now you've got this whole other thing of like, well, whereas Iwata would clearly have been front and center or something like that, we're not sure that they necessarily would see Kimishima, you know, in that capacity. And then, you know, even maybe people might think of Miyamoto, but technically he's the software czar. But then are we really thinking that Takeda's going to come out and do this? Like, look, the messaging, the presentation, all that, it's going to have to change a lot. They're still dealing with this.
Exactly. And I mean, it's all of that stuff. Like, everything would grind to a halt at his death. And really, their main concern would be really just keeping the wheels on, right? Just making sure things go smoothly over the next year.
I'm willing to bet that they weren't, and I don't want to say not surprised, but I'm willing to bet they were at least preparing, because he'd been sick for a long time.
Yeah,
and unlike us, who we had always kind of not really known what it was, we just knew he was sick, and then he wasn't really up for traveling, and they'd always kind of downplayed it in the public. I mean, they very much knew what it was. Like,
well, we could all assume they knew more than we did, but of course...
They understood it was serious at the very least.
Yeah, but at the same time, nature could take unexpected turns. I mean, we really don't know to what extent they could be prepared, or to what extent they were prepared, even if they could have been. I mean, it's just, you go way off into
I mean, at the very least, they were not aware that it was terminal, because if it would have been terminal, they would have had a success in place.
Sure.
He would have resigned. All of that stuff would have happened. So,
but you would have to assume that they were at least preparing for a long-term interim. Or they must have already had a long-term interim, because, I mean, even though they said he was still working, obviously when you're dealing with a medical thing, you're not going to be able to work 80 hours a week or whatever crazy hours he was undoubtedly putting into it.
Yeah, but I mean, still, like, actually having that happen and having to do it and put somebody in place and having to deal with everything that he wanted was involved in, and having to, like, retrofit that's a huge.
I would guess that they probably handled it about as well as you could. Like, I doubt it was just pure panic at any given moment. Like, that's, you know, there's the old, like, expression that this is what we trained for. Like, at some point, the people who were, you know, he was working with on all those initiatives, the you know, this is what you've been preparing for. You need to just run it. The top is where there's the biggest problem, but
well, I mean, and it's like a death in anybody's
family, right? What do you do when something tragic like that happens? I mean,
right.
Momentum
sort of keeps you going.
Well, yeah, but also, like, you hunker down and you focus on really what matters. Cut all the BS out and you do really what needs to be done, and don't worry about all of the extraneous stuff, which, you know, the Nintendo Directs, I mean, let's be honest. I mean, they were kind of extraneous, sort of, you know. I mean, yes, they were communicating to fans.
No, and it also seems like even they were somewhat surprised by how positive the reception was. You know, the clamor that developed for another one once we weren't getting very many. So, you know, I think, yeah, it's fair to say that, yeah, that is the kind of thing that they were quite happy to probably just, you know, pull back on while they got their bearings again with this sort of transition in the company. So I think eventually, you know, we're going to get to a point where, yeah, you know, once the new systems come out and they're established and all that, and the new corporate hierarchy's been established and all that, we'll probably get to a sort of equilibrium position somewhat like where we were before, but undoubtedly different because of the people involved.
Right.
Maybe it'll be more regional, you know, because if you can't really replace Iwata as that your singular spokesman because he's the top man of the company that could kind of go worldwide, you know, maybe it is going to be more of, you know, Reggie and Biltrin and in the States and Shibata in Europe and all that kind of stuff, you know.
And the North American one was always more regional. I mean, there were ones where the European one was just straight up part of the Japanese one.
We've talked about this, you know, many times, a little bit of brain training. Like, Europe has this thing with you, we're back to the sort of localizations that they ain't censoring anything. So, you
but
know,
like, there is no
censorship involved.
There would be European Nintendo Directs where it was just straight up the Japanese one that got overdubbed. And you're like, what the F is happening in Europe right now?
That's kind of interesting. Certainly they changed, you know, over time as well. But, I guess, you know, I hesitate to say it a little bit because it sounds a bit sort of sleazy almost, you know, given the context we talk about it with what a sad passing. But, you know, this kind of environment is in some ways better for new sites like ours because, you know, there is more. It's not just, well, you know, you get the news dump from Nintendo like clockwork and that's everything you need to know. You know, there is, like, interesting stuff out there right now to be found out through sites like ours. So, and there has been over the past several months, you know, like I said, you have stuff like that, Dragon Quest, you know, the 7 and 8 thing. You know, you basically had some idea about that, you know, months before if you were really deep into this following all the news stories on our site.
To that point, like, Earthbound 3, like, we've been hearing stuff about Earthbound 3 for at least 6 months.
And it just, you know, that's the thing. It doesn't kind of, I guess, the thing, you're never totally sure.
Right.
So it kind of, you know, it can rumble on and all that, but it certainly is different, you know, that just finding out blindly because Nintendo were, like, really prompt with a Nintendo Direct or something. Like, you know, it's, I'm sure, you know, it does make things more interesting for people working the news beats because there's these, you know, really, there's the Paper Mario rumor as well from Emily Rogers recently before she deleted her account or whatever. You know, that's another thing that seems like it's pretty credible. And, you know, if and when that gets announced on Paper Mario game for Wii U, it's going to be like, yep, well, we already knew about that. So, you know, that's the thing. I mean, I guess some people, you know, from an experience point of view, maybe would prefer to be for surprise, but then other people like having advanced information. It might influence your purchasing decisions. I mean, some people might have said, you know what, maybe I won't buy Paper Jam because there's a Paper Mario game for Wii U coming and I like the Paper Mario side more than the Mario & Luigi side or something, so I'll save my money for that. Like, that might have saved that hypothetical person money.
I would say that the more interesting thing that to think about, though, is run the thought experiment of, let's say nothing bad happened at Nintendo with the exception of the Wii U. Let's say the same Iwata hadn't passed, maybe even he hadn't gotten sick, and they're still doing what they were doing. You just raise a question of, what would they be Nintendo directing about right now anyway?
Like, no, that comes back to Guillaume's point, which was
very so important. At some point, like, I mean, you can only they're gonna have Nintendo directs for every Splatfest. Hey guys, it's a Splatfest for Pokemon Red versus Pokemon Blue.
Yeah, I know what you mean. But on the other hand, like, I mean, the other part of this that we talk about, like I said, for fans, in some ways, I think, you know, it's kind of nice to know things earlier, you know, the Nintendo wants you to know them in some cases, because, you know, they just want you to spend your money on their stuff, like, as soon as you can, whereas, you know, like, you might want to make, like, some kind of, if you had the chance to make forward planning decisions, you know, you would. So there's that. But from Nintendo's point of view, you know, sometimes these things where there isn't completely confirmed and all that kind of stuff, you could get sort of bad perceptions of things coming about. And we talked about this when we had the question about them handling things weirdly, you know, and the amiibo stuff for Twilight Princess and all that kind of thing. So this is the downside for them, I guess, is that on the one hand, yeah, it's like non-essential, you know, it's easy to see how they kind of strip it back while they're, you know, kind of finding themselves again in this transition, but, and you know, also because there is less stuff out there, but even just, you know, with the sort of relatively modest things they're dealing with now, they still could have had better messaging about Twilight Princess HD, for instance.
Yes,
they?
Absolutely.
So you could still make the argument that, you know, if things had been sort of just like as you were, they might have been more aggressive with that sort of thing had you know, the old Nintendo Direct structure still been rock solidly in place with Iwata on top of it.
Sure, that could be interesting. From the makers of Funky Barn, The Legend of Zelda Twilight Princess HD.
I made that joke once, and we should point out, I don't know whether we ever pointed out on air that they did, you know, it's sort of straight right of within Tantalus are the ones that, you know, have done a bunch of, like, the Deus Ex Human Revolution.
Yeah, I know.
People,
which but
it's pretty good. I played that during my retirement, and I enjoyed that.
It is difficult to imagine how much they would talk about that game now that we know the game is very much a... called a faithful port of the original.
It is, but like I said, I mean, with this amiibo stuff, you know, like, yeah, you know, they should have probably been a bit clear about that, you know, the way, I mean, you could argue it was the timing. Well, they did talk about it in a direct, but they did it in one where they probably hadn't figured out what they were going to do with the amiibo yet. And so, but if they were having them more regularly, though, that wouldn't be such an issue, would it? Because then it's, oh, well, we'll just cover that in the next one. You know, like, I think that's kind of the difference.
All right. That's going to do it for email this week. You can send your emails to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. And indeed, that's going to do it for the show. Remember, next week we will be doing our retroactive on Beautiful Joe for the GameCube. It's by the time you hear this, it's probably too late to get the game because we're going to be talking about it on Thursday. But if you've got thoughts or questions, comments, whatever, you can send them to the email or you can post them in the talkback thread for Beautiful Joe's retroactive. There'll be a link in the article for this story. Additionally, you continue to send your questions and comments for our Xenoblade thing that we'll do someday. I don't know. We're still working on it. And also, if you want to hear more of Greg, why don't you tell us where they can find more of you?
Just came out recently. The most recent edition of Radio Trivia Podcast Edition, number 140, came out. It's my annual appearance, even though I was on it a couple of months ago because of the telethon. But yeah, I do every year, once a year, I come on and pick most of the games so I don't look like an idiot or sound like an idiot anyway. Go through some soundtracks that I think are worth sharing and some silly trivia questions that sometimes are not at all helpful. But yeah, Radio Trivia Podcast Edition, if you haven't ever heard any of it before, if you didn't hear it on the telethon or whatever, fantastic show that Mike does.
Amazing.
Where we just play songs from game soundtracks and you have to guess what the game is. And we have like five of those during the course of an episode. I've heard every episode of that show and I've been on it once a year since 2008. So the long may that continue, and I hope you enjoy this year's selections.
It's getting really hard to pick music for that show now,
I always have to pick some games that came out in the past year, you know,
right.
That helps a lot because, yeah, the stuff that's, I think, isn't it creeping up to like 700 games almost or something? I mean,
it's a lot of
games have been used at this point. And also I cheat because I have an import one every time. So that kind of helps.
You're part of the problem. So, Greg, speaking of telling people games where a song came from. What's our ending music this week?
Yeah, this we're going to do it backwards here. We're going to tell you what it is before you hear it. It's crazy, isn't it? Yeah, but this is a selection made by KSO, who got in touch like anybody else can to suggest an ending music. And this is actually from Etrian Odyssey 3.
The Drowned City, Etrian Odyssey 3, yes.
Yeah, and yeah, so this is the sounds of Yuzo Koshiro doing sort of classic FM synth style. It should be very enjoyable.
Excellent. And on that, that's going to be the show. Bye, everybody.
Bye. Later.
Bye.